совсем усуп, он разложился на прессе, липовый лед, а перестройка все идет и идет по плану, и вся грязь превратилась в голый лед, и все идет по плану, все идет по плану. О моей судьбе захотелось на покой, я обещал ей не участвовать в военной игре, но на форности на моей серпе молот и звезда, как это трогательно, серпе молот и звезда, лихой фонарь, ожидания мотаются, и все идет по плану. Все идет по плану. А моей женой накормили толпу, мировым кулаком растоптали ей грудь, всенародной свободы растерзали ей плоть. Так закопайте ее во Христе, ведь все идет по плану. Все идет по плану, все идет по плану,
It is 5 after midnight on this Tuesday evening. You are listening to the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM, where we continue to struggle with technical snafus. So forgive us if we're still rough around the edges, adjusting to the new control board here. You've been listening to this introductory music, this very dark and ominous-sounding introductory music, is a Russian band called Civil Defense, which has recently, although it came out of the sort of punk anarchist scene in Russia, has recently been involved in some equally dark and ominous political developments in Russia as well. And we have in the studio with us some visiting activists from Russia who are here to talk to us about that. And we're going to go to them shortly, but before we do, a few words from our host, Peter Lamborn Wilson.
And greetings to you all. It's been a while since we've been on the air, and we do apologize for that, but here we are. And we've got our half hour back from the news. They very nicely decided to go on at 11, so they'll be off, hopefully, from now on, knock on wood, at midnight. So we'll be back with a full hour and a half for you from now on, which is good news. At least I think it's good news. Is it good news? I just have a few reviews and quick reviews and notices before we get to the meat of the show, which is about Russia tonight. So just to tell you, there's a new AK distribution catalog, 1996 catalog, arrived in the mail today. AK, along with Left Bank Press, is, I suppose, that they are the two best anarchist book catalogs in America right now. AK which used to be in Edinburgh, had moved to San Francisco some years ago, and their address, if you have your pencils sharpened, AK Press, P.O. Box, to take my glasses off here, 40682, San Francisco, 40682, San Francisco, California, 94140-0682. And they have some new publications from their own press, including essays by Nestor Makhno, which was interesting. I've actually already read that. And a very, very stupid book by Murray Bookchin, in which he attacks all sorts of people.
Certain personalities,
friends,
yes.
Friends of ours, yes. Et cetera, et cetera. So that's AK Press. And it's a huge catalog, by the way, not only of their own publications. It's got 112 pages of teeny tiny print of anarchist and related material from all over the world, stuff that you won't probably get from anybody else, possibly not even from Left Bank, because AK has a strong connection with the UK. And so they have English publications, which Left Bank probably would generally not have. The World Music Institute is having a benefit for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and itself, the World Music Institute. It's going to be on Thursday, March 21st. That's not yet, is it? No, we haven't got there yet. At Town Hall, there's going to be a cocktail reception, a silent auction, performance of Balinese dance, and a club expo dance party, whatever that is. Lots of people are going to be there, including some WBAI folks. I see their names on the benefit committee. And Ornette Coleman, Phil Glass, people like that will be present as well. So it should be a very nice occasion. The thing is, of course, since it's a benefit, they want you to actually pay a minimum of $25 for a ticket. So I don't think, you know, I'm not going to put my tux on and go that evening, but anyway. You might like to, and of course it is for a very, very good cause. And so if you're interested in doing that and rubbing elbows with the likes of Delphine Blue and Muzaffar Chishti, what you should do is get in touch with the responsible parties at the World Music Institute by calling 212-545-7536. It says RSVP by March 11th, but I have a feeling that they might make an exception if you were being in a generous mood. 212-545-7536 to support one of our favorite causes. Bang on a Can is also trying to raise money. They're the people who do very exciting new music, like the Bang on a Can Marathon. And they, in fact, have a season coming up with the Bang on a Can All-Stars at Walter Reed Theater between March 25th and April 22nd. They lost $50,000 this year in funding because of government cuts, so they're interested in finding generous people as well. Gosh, aren't we all? In fact, before you consider donating to these other causes, you might give the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade a ring, or even WBAI, for that matter. But if you want to support Bang on a Can, it's 212-777-8442. 212-777-8442. And you can also find out about their upcoming events at the Knitting Factory, Lincoln Center, so forth and so on. Always very exciting. Then we have the rival anarchist walking tours, radical walking tours, the Bruce Caton one and the Bob's one.
Are they really rival, or are they complementary?
No, they're sort of I like to, you know, stir up a little excitement here by calling them rivals, but they're really more like friends. The walking tour of Radical New York that leaves from 339 Lafayette Street, a.k.a. the Peace Pentagon, is kicking off with a tour on Saturday, April 6th, that will leave from 339 Lafayette. But if you want information about where they're going to go, call 718-262-0948. This is the radical walking tour that the two Bobs are responsible for, Bob and Bob. That's 718-262-0948. I noticed that they're going to go look where Walt Whitman wrote poetry. I was just reading last night about Pfaff's Beer Cellar. Do you know about that, Bill?
And no.
It was the first American, first New York bohemian hangout. It was on the corner of Broadway and Bleecker. And it was a restaurant that was under the sidewalk, and Walt Whitman and his buddies used to go and hang out there and drink
Indeed.
Beer.
What's yeah. there now?
I don't know. And maybe one of the Radical Walking Tour guys could tell us. Pfaff's is long since, I mean, that we're talking about pre-Civil War here.
Bleecker and
Broadway.
Hmm. Well, maybe it's the NoHo Star.
that would be something.
No, that's Bleecker and Lafayette.
Yeah, that's another block over. The other Radical Walking Tours by Bruce Caton, they're taking off very soon, too. This is, you know, walking tour weather we've got, or not today, but soon, hopefully. And they have many different things. I won't bother to tell you all the details, but also the idea is you walk around downtown and see where all the exciting things happened in the leftist and labor and anarchist history. And their telephone number is 718-492-0069. 718-492-0069. Go on both of them. Do a little comparison shopping. Friends and Enemies of New Music present the Talu John Percussion Quartet Wednesday, March 20th.
Tomorrow
at 8 p.m. at the Washington Square Church, 135 West 4th Street. For reservations, call 212-749-1324. 749-1324. Excuse me. The Hunter students are taking to the streets again. I think that's what this is all about, isn't it?
They just had a report about that on the news.
Right. The folks who actually succeeded in bringing back a little breath of the good old days when they were repressed by the police last year in their march down in the Wall Street area, they're taking off again to protest new massive budget cuts in education. This Thursday, March 21st, gather 12 noon at Times Square, march to rally at City Hall. And if you want any further information on that, call 212-642-2549. 642-2549. The Moroccan Hommage au Maroc celebration, the homage to Morocco, it's still going on at the French Institute, March 14th to March 20th, so there's not much left of it, but I just thought I'd mention it. They have a film series from Morocco, which is certainly still going on, and a couple of lectures in French, I'm afraid, which are still yet to happen. You may have missed the food tasting, which would probably be of the most interest, and the night of music, a night in Marrakesh, that's already also just happened. So, but there's still some interesting-looking films to see, and if you want to investigate further and find out what is still to be experienced, try calling 212-355-6100, 355-6100. That's the French Institute, and ask them about their Hommage au Maroc. And that's about it, I guess. Are we interested in the billion letters to Mumia Abu-Jamal? Should I say something about that?
Go ahead.
I'm a little dubious about it because it's in the form of a letter to the Attorney General, which I don't know. But, you know, one must do what one can do. And you can get a copy of this letter or do other good things, perhaps even much more useful things for the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition, by getting in touch with them at 212-281-4973. You could ask for a copy of the letter. They want to send a million letters to Janet Reno. Or you could volunteer to do other things, or at least find out what they're up to by calling 212-281-4973. Needless to say, don't call any of these numbers now. It's not at all a civilized time. Wait until tomorrow during business hours, and then I'm sure all these people will be overjoyed to hear from you. So that's all from me, Bill, for the time being, and so I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce our friends from Russia.
Okay, with
us, et cetera.
Well, from Russia and from Germany, with us
love.
in the studio, joining us tonight are Vadim Damir, who is a representative of CRAS, the Confederation of Revolutionary Anarcho-Syndicalists, joining us from Moscow. And Marcus Mathiel was a member of the anarchist opposition in East Germany, who is traveling with Vadim. And also our comrade from the Lower East Side, Misha Kutkin, who is a Russian radio journalist living here in New York, who's going to be helping us out with translations. Well, for starters, maybe you could tell us a bit about this band that we heard, Civil Defense, and what makes them so controversial. Can you talk into the mic more?
His mic is not on.
His mic is not on. Oh, that's the problem. Okay, remedied.
Okay, it is important to note that this band was a part of the counterculture, the Soviet counterculture, which developed in the 1980s, the punk counterculture, and that the band was suppressed during Soviet times. The leader of the band, the singer, Igor Lietov, was imprisoned in a psychiatric ward. You call it, I think, nut ward or something like this. And that this band performed in the past, I would say, anti-Soviet and anarchist, anti-militaristic songs. And now they became a part of the so-called Red-Brown Youth Movement, which has to be seen as a part of a more general development in Russia towards nationalism. For many people in Russia, when this band first joined the nationalists and performed in concerts where leading ideologues of the National Patriots, Russian National Patriots, took active part, everybody was shocked. Now you can already speak about an established Red-Brown Youth Movement, and this band totally changed. It is still not totally understandable, but it is something which has to be acknowledged, and there is very few information about this.
The song that we were listening to, what was that from their earlier period when they were more anarchistic? What was the message of that song? What were the words like?
That was from an earlier period, and the song was, was written in the beginning of Perestroika. And the words go something like Lenin's corpse is running away, but the perestroika is going on. It's okay, everything goes according to plan. And then he says something like Lenin was a great leader, everybody else is a shithead. And I'm sure the same thing goes on in North Korea. The communists promise you everything. And so it was an anti-communist song.
Mm-hmm.
But Lenin was a great leader.
Yeah.
Facetiously,
well,
or
ironically, I suppose.
I suppose ironically.
Yeah. Yeah.
People understood it at this time.
And what year was this? What year did this song come out?
I suppose this song was
85, 86?
87, 86, 87.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. And when was the leader of the band or the singer of the band locked up?
It was in, let's see, I have it written down. It was in 85, and I guess what is important to note, it happened during a time when Gorbachev already became into power, so this proves that at the beginning of the perestroika, these drastic measures against youth deviation and other deviation didn't change so rapidly.
And had the band already made recordings by then? And were they sort of Samizdat-type recordings, or...?
This band first put a record out, I think, in 1990, because as other underground bands in the Soviet Union, they had to mm-hmm. record under very primitive conditions. So mm-hmm. they would record their bands mainly on very primitive tape recorders. But it is important, or it is interesting, Igor Lietov tells sometimes in interviews about the way
he's the singer?
Yeah. He's the singer, yeah. The way how he records one track and re-records this track with additional instruments, and also tries to get some special effect by this. And this early recordings are really rough. You can hear it. Mm. And once he even said that when they got the possibility to use the studio later, with another very well-known band, Auktion, from St. Petersburg, he refused to use the studio because he realized that their sound couldn't be produced in such a studio, and he went back to Siberia.
So are they now big? I mean, have they become, they had a commercial release and they became big and they became stars?
You can't say that they are, they became stars by now. They are really a legend. They are a legend of the underground, Soviet underground scene. And they were big because they sang the songs of the Soviet punk rockers. I would say that they were a legend and are still a legend. Mm. They are pretty big.
I would call them a cult band, which has a limited but
very devoted following.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not major stars, but a lot of punks and all kinds of people like
that. So when did the change in their politics hit in? When did they sort of abandon left-wing anarchism for this strange sort of red-brown politics which is emerging in Russia now?
The first, for me, remarkably change happened when they participated in the first Russian Breakthrough concert. This was in December 1993, so right after the October events that happened 2 months before. And this Russian Breakthrough event was a concert where leading ideologues of the Russian nationalist movement took part also in a press conference and tried to present this red-brown fusion, the fusion of left and right ideology, as something natural and something which also has to happen in the youth culture.
Okay, fusing around what? Where's the common ground?
The common ground is hard to say. They would literally say that it is something naturally that the extremes go together, and the extremes against the center, and
are we talking about Pamyat and that kind of nationalist right, or is this are there separate new groupings to mobilize this third path or red brown alliance?
They are certainly successors of Pamyat. So if you speak about Pamyat, you have to acknowledge that this kind of nationalism in Russia is pretty much out now, because this organization was big in the end of the 80s, and they were very, very backward oriented with their ideology. They were monarchists, they were anti-communist, and they would always demonize rock music as a monstrous product of satanic and even Zionist forces, how the leader Vasilyev put it once. So after 1991, there was a remarkably change in the Russian nationalism. A kind of modernization took place, and what we see now, like this red-brown youth movement, is a part of this modernization. So they try to use our rock music and other things to attract young people.
How did they get, if what they've done is smart, how did they get smart? Who smartened them up? Who told them to forget all the old dusty monarchism and get hip with the punk music and so forth? Who gave them this advice? Where did this idea come from? France, for example? Germany?
I think you just have to look to the current leader of this youth movement, Eduard Limonov, who you might be familiar with this name, because
I'm quite familiar. I used to know about him when he was a dissident poet in England.
Right. No. He lived in New York.
In New York.
He lived in New York.
He was in London for a while too, I believe.
Right. Now, was he among the people who spoke at this Russian revival rally in '93, where Civil Defense played?
He was advertised to attend, but he didn't attend. But later he attended, and I have a video of one Russian Breakthrough concert where he really got the people high. I don't know if this is the right expression. Like, he shouted slogans like Russia to the Russians and Russification for Russia. He said, we are the biggest white nation in Europe. We are 130 million. And he appears much more contemporary. Just the outlook, he doesn't have this traditional Russian clothes on him. He wears a baseball cap and a leather jacket.
And he's the leader of a so-called National Bolshevik Party. Yeah. What I failed to grasp, I mean, obviously there's certain common ground emerging, you know, behind Russian nationalism and standing up to the West and NATO and the IMF and so on, but how do ostensible Bolsheviks, ostensible, you know, revolutionary lefty types, reconcile, you know, this kind of blatantly racist rhetoric, you know, we're the biggest white nation on the planet, blah, blah, blah. That's what I don't quite grasp.
It's hard to say. I mean, if you speak about leftism and radical, even radical leftism in the Soviet Union, you have to acknowledge that a kind of leftist ideology, whatever you want to call it, Bolshevism or Stalinism, was in power. So people, if people participate, they identify themselves with very authoritarian elements of this kind of dictatorship. What happened if they put them in this tradition, though, they reconcile with their own past, they reconcile with their own authoritarian past.
Also, this third way goes back. I mean, first of all, we could trace it all the way back into German Romanticism in the early 19th century, but could certainly also trace it to the immediate aftermath of the First World War, when Germany and Russia were both anti-Versailles treaty powers, and there was a very strong movement on the right in Germany and Hungary, well, the White International, all that business, an attempt to make geopolitical interests between emerging right-wing forces in Germany and elsewhere on the one hand and Bolshevism on the other hand. So you had a whole hidden history in the Nazi Party, which actually then manifested in the Hitler-Stalin Pact for a short while. And for a very short time, these third-way people were...
Had the upper hand.
They had the upper hand.
In both Moscow and Berlin.
It was their moment of glory. And I think that this, what we're seeing now, I would imagine, has direct historical roots that go back at least to 1919.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. People like Dugin, Alexander Dugin, who is also a part of this Red-Brown Youth Movement, he is the leading ideologue of Russian nationalism. He reprints like the so-called conservative revolutionaries.
Oh, Carl Schmitt. And
yeah,
all
Carl
like
Schmitt,
that, yeah.
Haushofer, yeah. The Continental Pact, and stuff like that. So he makes these things available.
And then there's the Strasserite tendency too, the sort of left-wing National Socialism, which I'm sure has a certain appeal to these people. Otto and Rudolf, the brothers' names, Strassers, mm-hmm. the ones that Hitler had to get rid of because they were too left-wing.
Or too populist. I'm not even sure I would say left-wing.
Yeah, well, yeah. Social. I mean, it was Hitler's way of getting rid of any real socialism that was left in the National Socialist groupings.
Yeah, that was even before, you know, the Night of the Long Knives.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting secret history. People think that this third wave thing emerged in the 60s and 70s with these youth camps in Europe, but I think it goes way back, and I'm sure that there's some very old creaky people, not just young people like Limonov, but I'm sure there's some very old people behind all this somewhere.
Misha,
no, Vadim wanted to join the discussion.
Please.
Да, я хотел сказать еще о том, что исторические корни вот этой вот этого вот чудовищного синтеза между вроде бы левыми элементами и чисто правыми элементами, они, в общем-то, могут быть прослежены в историю и еще в другую сторону. Дело в том, что Эдуард Лимонов, лидер национал-большевистской партии, который издает сейчас газету «Лимонка», он совершенно откровенно копирует Муссолини. Причем Муссолини раннего, Муссолини накануне прихода к власти и в первый момент после прихода.
I would like to add also about the historical roots of this macabre right-brown alliance that's taking place now, that it could be traced in another direction. The person we're talking about, Eduard Limonov, who publishes his own paper and is the leader of National Bolshevik Party, his style is very much reminiscent of early Mussolini. Mm.
И дело здесь не только в таком подчеркнуто футуристическом стиле, к которому прибегает Муссолини.
And the thing is, it's not only this very futuristic style of Mussolini.
Здесь даже можно найти параллели даже в совершенно конкретных политических заявлениях.
We could also see some very direct parallels in specific political statements.
Например, когда началось вторжение в Чечню, то газета «Лимонка», газета «Лимонова» выступила с совершенно тем же лозунгом, который провозгласил Муссолини в 1915 году: «Война — это свобода».
For example, when the intervention in Chechnya started, Limonov's newspaper came out with the exact same slogan that Mussolini proclaimed in 1915: "War is freedom."
И естественно сразу же последовало обращение к окопной аристократии с призывом понять, что незачем проливать, кровь за чуждые, так сказать, интересы какой-то олигархии, что необходимо, так сказать, служить национальным интересам России, необходимо осознать себя как носители этих интересов и действовать соответственно.
And so there was some appeals not to spill Russian blood for some kind of oligarchy, but to defend the real interests of Russia and the Russian people.
What does that concretely mean? What is the stance of Limonov and the Red Browns in general towards the war in Chechnya?
Что это означает конкретно, каково отношение Лимонова и его товарищей к войне в Чечне?
Отношение самое восторженное. Они приветствуют войну, они полностью стоят на стороне российского государства, полностью стоят на стороне российской армии. Они полностью оправдывают все те преступные акты, которые были совершены этой армией против мирного населения. И в тот момент, когда российская армия захватила президентский дворец в Грозном, газета «Лимонка» вышла под огромной шапкой: «Ура, Грозный взят!»
What that means is that they support the war completely. They support the criminal actions of the Russian army in Chechnya. They, when the Russian troops finally, after some long battle, took over the presidential palace in Grozny, the Chechen capital, the Limonov's newspaper came out with a huge headline saying something like, "Hooray, the Grozny is ours."
Аргументация, между прочим, у Лимонова не только и не столько в данном случае чисто расовая, российская, сколько скорее такая державно-националистическая.
The argumentation of Limonov is not purely racialist in this matter, but it could be defined perhaps more precisely as state patriotic.
С его точки зрения, чеченцы и вообще население Северного Кавказа — это исторические враги российского русского государства.
From his point of view, the Chechens and the people who live in the northern Caucasus mountains historically are the enemies of the Russian state.
Поэтому они то, что называется злой народ.
So therefore they are the so-called angry people.
И воевать с ними следует не только в Чечне, но и на территории, собственно, самой России.
And the fight with them should be taken not only to Chechnya, but also on the Russian territory, on the territory of Russia proper.
Отсюда бешеная антикавказская пропаганда.
So therefore there is a rabid anti-Caucasian propaganda, Caucasian in this sense, meaning people
Muslims
from the Caucasus.
Meaning Muslims and Chechens.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In other words, against Caucasian immigrants in Moscow and all that sort of thing.
Да.
Mm-hmm. Which are called blacks in Russian, by the way.
Right.
As opposed to so-called scientific racism, is the ideology that they're working on more of the clash of cultures, the North versus South, the European versus the non-European, that kind of thing?
I think this is also true for this National Bolshevist organization, like the National Bolshevist Party of Limonov, because they are organized in this so-called European Liberation Front.
Yeah.
So they have the common ground European, which is seems to be very much like a paradigm or change in the whole neo-Nazi movement.
Mm. Again, this was a tendency, I think, that you could trace back as far as you wanted to trace it back. I mean, not even all the Nazi Party were interested in scientific racism. But this, what's interesting about it now is that, as I read it, the major influence for this thinking, for this ideology, is coming from France, from the so-called New Right, and people like Alain de Benoit. Mm-hmm. And I understand that de Benoit has been very active in Russia, and I'd like to hear what you can tell me, what you can all tell me about his activities theories and how they're being received.
It is, for instance, interesting to see that Alain de Benoit is an editorial staff member of this Russian theoretic nationalist paper, which is called Elementi. Mm. It's the counterpart of Elements, which is published in France. So there have been different meetings of the French New Right, including Alain de Benoit, Robert Stoikers from Belgium, and during these meetings, there participated people like Babourin and other higher politicians, which at those times, I think it was in 1991, were members of the Russian or Soviet Parliament at this time. And I think that this, as far as I know, that this Babourin is now the vice president of the Russian Parliament. Vice president?
No.
Okay, but
he's a member of parliament.
Yeah, he's a member of the parliament, and this Elementi. What is also important to note is that this Elementi newspaper was founded in 1991, mm-hmm. with the support of the political headquarter of the Soviet army.
Mm. Yeah,
Vadim.
Да, ну этот журнал Элементы первоначально вообще задумывался как некий общий проект. То есть это должен был быть международный журнал с международной редакцией.
This magazine Elements was conceived as an international project that would have an international editorial board.
И в этой международной редакции значились и Ален де Бенуа, и Дугин, и люди из других стран.
And so Ален де Бенуа and Дугин, this Russian nationalist, and also people from other countries were part of this editorial board.
Так оно некоторое время, в общем-то, и было, до тех пор, пока, ну вот в данный момент, например, можно наблюдать конфликт между Дугиным и Аленом де Бенуа.
But right now there is a conflict between Dugin and Alain de Benoit.
Дело в том, что для де Бенуа слишком чрезмерные, с его точки зрения, симпатии Дугина к большевизму и коммунистам, ну, недопустимы.
For Alain de Benoit, the position that Dugin takes towards Bolsheviks and communists too much. He likes them too much. Mm. He's too sympathetic to this.
И все-таки это скорее тактика, чем расхождения какие-то серьезные теоретические.
But it seems to me that it's more a question of tactics rather than a serious theoretical disagreement.
There should be at least one serious theoretical disagreement, and that should be over self-determination of minorities. I mean, de Benoit comes out in France supporting the rights of Algerian immigrants and so forth and so on. Now, I mean, I have nothing to say about his sincerity or his lack of sincerity, but he does this. And so how could de Benoit go along with a bunch of people who are calling the Chechens blacks and crushing them because of these racist, cultural, chauvinist ideas?
С одной стороны, это так. Казалось бы, так сказать, Дугин с вот этой логикой поддержки чеченской войны должен был бы противоречить такой позиции. Но это не совсем так.
On one hand, it seems that it's true what you're saying, that Dugin, with his support of the Chechen war, should be in conflict with de Benoit, but it's not quite so.
Yes, I'm sure.
Например, можно увидеть в газетах национал-большевиков российских, скажем, возражения против такого резкого антисемитизма со стороны других националистов.
For example, in some of the national Bolshevik papers in Russia, you can see polemics against the extreme anti-Semitism that could be found in other publications.
Здесь логика примерно такая, что все культуры хороши, но только когда они не смешиваются.
The logic here is goes along the lines of all the cultures are good as long as they don't mix with each other.
Right, mm-hmm. That's more like de Benoit.
Совершенно верно. Yeah. Это скорее сближает с Бенуа.
Keep him on their on their side of the Caucasus Mountains.
Yeah.
Keep him far away from Moscow. Yeah. But I guess what I don't get is, I mean, these people oppose Yeltsin, and this is Yeltsin's war. So wouldn't they see it at least in their expedient interest to use this as political ammunition against Yeltsin? I mean, clearly they're the war is very unpopular, at least in, you know, in certain quarters.
Они считают, ну, отношение у националистов различных течений и партий к режиму Ельцина неоднозначное.
Different factions of nationalists, different tendencies have different approaches to Yeltsin.
Например, Лимонов, его национал-большевистская партия, вместе с некоторыми другими осколками, отколами от других националистических группировок, более маленькими, открыто поддерживает сейчас именно Ельцина и его кандидатуру в президенты.
For example, Эдуард Лимонов and his National Bolshevik Party and also the remnants of some smaller nationalist factions are now openly backing Yeltsin's candidacy for president.
Это течение сейчас провело где-то вот в феврале, может быть, конгресс в Петербурге.
This faction, this structure sort of had a congress in February in St. Petersburg.
И объявили, что с его точки зрения Ельцин является наиболее последовательным националистом из нынешних претендентов на пост президента.
Where Limonov actually said that from his point of view, Yeltsin is the most consistent nationalist of the current candidates running.
Именно потому, что он осмелился начать эту войну.
Precisely because he was brave enough to start the Chechen War.
С другой стороны, с точки зрения этих людей, Зюганов, поскольку он лидер коммунистов, не, ну, является, что ли, подозрительным, поскольку коммунизм все-таки в какой-то степени идеология интернационалистская.
And on the other hand, the candidacy of Gennady Zyuganov, who's the leader of the Communist Party, is suspect in the eyes of these people, because communism is still kind of an internationalist idea.
С другой стороны, другие националисты заявляют, что Ельцин они не будут поддерживать ни в коем случае, и заявили, что они будут поддерживать Зюганова.
But other nationalists say that there is no way they can support Yeltsin, and they will support Zyuganov.
But it has clearly to be pointed out that this Limonov position is a minority position, even among the radical nationalists.
I was going to ask how much support Limonov really has himself personally. I mean, he may be a bit of a star at the moment, but what does that mean in terms of, first of all, votes, and second of all, people with guns?
I would think that Limonov certainly is not that popular. I see this whole development and this emergence of the Red Front Youth Movement more as a tactic of the nationalists, who of course have quarrels among themselves, but who use certain tactics. To achieve our cultural hegemony, and this is an aim which they have,
in December,
yes.
And they failed to get elected.
Okay, what about Zyuganov, the communist candidate? I mean, how much brown, that is to say, you know, nationalist right support does he have behind him, as opposed to red support? To what extent is the Red-Brown Alliance coming together behind Zyuganov?
Firstly, it has to be pointed out that Zyuganov in 1991 was the co-chairman of the big first left and right coalitions, the National Council, Russian Council, and the National Front of Salvation. These were really big left-right oppositional blocs, which nearly included all opposition to Yeltsin. This was in 1992, 1 year after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and that he later then became the leader of the Communist Party in 1993, because in 1993 the CPRF was re-established.
Mm-hmm.
And
Communist Party of the Russian Federation.
Yeah, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. So these big left-right coalitions were first, and were created in a kind of interim period. And I would say that the Communist Party received much support and are acknowledged as the leading patriot forces in Russia, and that it now includes in their party strong nationalist elements. So I would call the Communist Party of the Russian Federation red-brown inside. Mm. Mm. From inside, yeah.
Вадим.
Дело в том, что в идеологии КПРФ, в ее программатике, в заявлениях ее лидеров, националистический элемент присутствует крайне отчетливо.
In all the statements of the CPRF, in the statements of its leaders, the nationalist element is quite clear.
Это можно почувствовать и в нескольких книгах, которые выпустил Зюганов, например, книги «Держава».
It could also be seen and traced in several books that Геннадий Зюганов has authored.
А один из идеологов КПРФ, Шабанов, пошел еще дальше.
And one of the ideologues of the Communist Party, his name is Shabanov, he went even further.
Он заявил, что революция 17-го года была организована, ну, повторил известный тезис о том, что революция 17-го года была организована сионистами, которые стремились разрушить русское государство.
He repeats the well-known canard that the revolution of 1917 was perpetrated by the Zionists, it was a result of a Zionist plot.
Но, конечно, он
this
не
is
был
somebody within the Communist Party,
yes.
is alleged.
Одну минуту, да,
the co-chairman.
Да, да, минуту.
Yes.
Но, он не был бы, конечно,
oh,
он не был бы, конечно,
world.
Он не был бы, конечно, деятелем коммунистической партии, если бы он при этом не попытался свою партию оправдать. Он не был бы лидером коммунистической партии, если бы он не попытался оправдать свою партию за участие в революции.
Right. Well, yes, of course, but he wouldn't have been a good member of the Communist Party if he didn't try, after saying that, to somehow justify the party that he's a member of.
И пришлось ему придумать хитроумное объяснение.
So he came up with a quite clever explanation.
Mm-hmm. Вроде бы Ленин и окружавшие его мудрые партийные люди.
So according to which Lenin and other wise men who surrounded him,
они знали, они просчитали эти хитрые шаги сионистов и использовали их в своих целях.
They knew all about this devious Zionist plot, but they
yes,
used
Trotsky,
it.
No
they used it in their own way for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm. После чего Сталину, как законному преемнику Ленина, удалось сионистов отстранить и восстановить русскую державу.
After which Stalin, as a Lenin's successor, managed to destroy the Zionists and to restore the Russian
mm-hmm.
state.
Mm-hmm.
Вот к таким вот, так сказать, хитроумным штукам приходится иногда прибегать лидерам коммунистической партии Российской Федерации.
This is an example of some clever, convoluted
yes,
no, explanations.
Who is the author of this arcane theory?
His name is Shabanov. And he's, what's his
position? Он преподаватель Московского университета.
He also teaches at Moscow University.
And he's in the KPRF?
Да, он, ну, в общем, третья или четвертая формальная фигура в партийной иерархии.
In a party hierarchy, he's a third or fourth mm-hmm. person.
So what is Zhuganov's background? What was he doing, you know, back in the bad old days before Glasnost?
I
think that he was responsible, or he was working in the part of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was dealing with ideology.
Mm-hmm.
So he is coming from this side of party work.
Mm-hmm.
He was a secretary of the Central Committee of the CPSU.
So he was sort of a party line guy. He didn't make waves. He wasn't a dissident or anything like that. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask a tangential or a question off to the side here about all of this activity. I understand that it's also very much mixed up with mysticism and the revival of certain religious ideas, perhaps within Orthodoxy, psychic discoveries behind the Iron Curtain, witchcraft, neo-shamanism. In your view, is all of this stuff exclusively mixed up with reactionary elements, or is there also, how can we put it, a sort of progressive New Age possibility in the former Soviet Union?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, is this supernatural stuff split between left and right, or does it belong mostly to the right, or what?
Ну, в общем, насколько мне представляется, вот это вот мистическое течение, оно в России современной, оно, в общем и целом, занимает правые позиции.
As it seems to me, this mystical movement, on the whole, is to the right.
Ну, правда, надо сказать, что в этом, что националисты в отношении, так сказать, к религии, они не едины.
But it must be said that the nationalists, among the nationalists, there are also different approaches to religion.
Есть силы, которые ориентируются на православную церковь.
There are forces that are aligning themselves with the Orthodox Church.
Right. Есть, так сказать, неоязычники, которые заявляют, что христианство плохо, поскольку придумано евреями, и надо вернуться к старой дохристианской славянской вере.
There are some who are neo-pagans who say that Christianity is bad because it was thought up by Jews, so we should go to the pre-Christian religions.
Ну и, наконец, есть вот эти новые правые, которые пытаются использовать элементы теософии, ариософии, то есть вот тех вещей, которыми интересовались фелькиши в начале 20 века.
And then there are the new right people who are interested in the same theories that Fölkischer was doing.
Is there actually
theosophy, ariosophy? Yes. I heard him mention that.
Is there actually a revival of interest in the, you know, ancient Slavic gods of pre-Christian times?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Neo-paganism is big there now.
Древним славянским богам.
Ну вот среди этого языческого крыла, безусловно, да.
Yes, among this pagan wing, of course.
Remember, I don't know if you were here. I read a little piece from that religion watch paper that I get about some, is there a part of Russia that's called Mari, M-A-R-I? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. They said that this part had Mari, even more pagans there than Christians. But I couldn't understand whether they meant traditional pagans or neo-pagans.
Well, I would imagine the traditional pagans had sort of been exterminated.
That's what one would have thought.
These would have to be nostalgists at this point. I would assume so, anyway.
Is there such a thing as real, genuine pagans in Russia?
Если настоящие язычники.
Сложно сказать, знаю только, что, например, на Украине есть человек, который называет себя колдуном и анархоязычником. Он считает, что, так сказать, вот в этой самой дохристианской вере имелись определенные либертарные тенденции, которые вот нужно возродить посредством освобождения человека, единения с природой, слияния с природой.
It's hard for me to say, I'm not really an expert on this, but I can say that somewhere in Ukraine there is a guy who calls himself an anarcho-pagan, and he says that the pagan religions had a libertarian aspect to them. And he talks about unity of man and nature.
That idea would be more, you know, would find more sympathy with the American neo-pagans, who are the most.
Although we have our neo-pagan, neo-Nazi tradition
as
well.
Of course, but it's not very well understood in America how in Europe these connections are made, or in the old world.
Well, they're being made here as well among all these Odin-worshipping Nazis out in Montana and so on.
Yes, but they're a minority in the neo-pagan movement.
Yes,
they
are.
Very small minority.
Well,
and if you talk to most of them, you'll find that they're kind of feel-good anarchists at the most.
They don't feel very good to me, man.
They feel good to themselves, anyway.
Я, правда, должен сказать, что этот человек, он, в общем, в меньшинстве в анархическом движении, на него смотрят как на что-то такое экзотическое.
I should say that this person I was speaking of is in a minority in an anarchist movement, and he is seen as something of an exotic bird.
Yeah, I wanted to, I didn't want to get sidetracked onto this. It's a personal interest of mine, but I also wanted to ask, now, unless you had more questions.
Well, I do, but go ahead.
I just wanted to, you know, start talking about the anarchist movement and how it's reacting to these
well, that was one of my questions.
Issues,
yeah.
what kind of a militant anti-reactionary forces there could be, what their prospects of success could be.
Or having heard your talk at Blackout Books, our local anarchist bookstore on the Lower East Side last night, let me ask, what remnants of the Russian anarchist movement are left, still exist, which have not been co-opted by the nationalist right?
Да, но анархистов в России, в общем, не так много, скорее мало.
Yes, it's true that there are not a lot of anarchists in Russia, one can say very few.
Правда, с моей точки зрения, вот те данные, те цифры, которые приводились в начале перестройки о том, что вот в России несколько тысяч анархистов, это, в общем, в значительной степени, как мне кажется, был такой некий конфуз.
In the beginning of Perestroika, there were some numbers being mentioned that there are thousands of anarchists in Russia, but those numbers seem to be a result of confusion.
Понятно, что после десятилетий такого всеобъемлющего, давящего, контролирующего государства у многих молодых людей возникало совершенно естественное желание как-то этому государству, ну, что ли, противопоставиться.
It's quite natural that after decades of this strict totalitarian state, a lot of young people felt the need to confront the state and to establish their own identity.
Ну вот они назвали себя, называли, стали называть себя анархистами.
So they started to call themselves anarchists.
Другое дело, что по разным причинам они стали себя так называть.
But they had different reasons for calling themselves that.
Одни, потому что действительно считали, что государство как таковое неприемлемо, и нужно искать какие-то другие формы человеческого общежития.
Some people really thought that the state itself is unacceptable and other forms of human cohabitation should be looked at.
На основе самоуправления, самоорганизации.
Talking about self-government, self-organization.
Другие же просто считали, что вот та форма государства, которая была, вот эта тоталитарная форма, что она как бы не ограничивает возможности для их личного преуспеяния, их личной карьеры, их богатства.
But there were other people who thought that that particular form of totalitarian state that existed in the Soviet Union was limiting their life, their personal ambition, their careers, their success, and so on.
Они объявили себя анархо-капиталистами или анархо-демократами.
So they started calling themselves anarcho-capitalists or anarcho-democrats.
И после того, как получили возможность как бы удовлетворить свои притязания, в общем-то успокоились.
And after they more or less achieved what the goals were, they were content.
They became yuppies, huh?
Yeah, они стали yuppies. Да, для кого-то это просто была возможность для того, чтобы их заметили, чтобы потом сделать политическую карьеру.
And for some people it was also calling themselves anarchists was a way to make a career in politics.
Mm. Mm-hmm. What about anarcho-syndicalism? What about actual working class anarchism?
Среди рабочих.
Ну, общее количество. В результате можно сказать, что анархистов осталось, как я уже сказал, совсем мало. И, в частности, анархо-синдикалистов общее количество сейчас может оцениваться, ну, в, может быть, 1-2 сотни человек.
So as a result of all this, as I said, the number of real anarchists dwindled substantially, and now there is about 1 to 200 anarcho-syndicalists in Russia.
К тому же анархо-синдикалистское движение в бывшем Союзе сильно расколото.
And the anarcho-syndicalist movement in the former Soviet Union is split up.
Существует не одна организация, а три, может быть.
There is not one, but maybe three different organizations.
С разным представлением об анархо-синдикализме.
With different views of anarcho-syndicalism.
С разной международной ориентацией.
With a different international orientation.
И взаимодействие между этими организациями часто, в общем, достаточно затруднено.
And cooperation between these different organizations is often quite difficult.
Возвращаясь к вопросу о сопротивлении, возможности сопротивления, реакции на фашизм, могу только сказать, что, конечно, при таком небольшом количестве анархистов о каком-то милитантном сопротивлении в общем и целом, конечно, речь не идет.
Speaking of possible resistance to right-wing fascist threat, given the small number of anarcho-syndicalists that we have, one cannot speak of any kind of militant response.
Хотя были, конечно, отдельные столкновения, стычки, все было.
Although there were some physical confrontations and such.
But what about anarchists other than syndicalists? Or what about, you know, principled anti-fascists other than anarchists altogether, you know? I mean, is there any kind of, you know, hope for some kind of backbone among youth culture? Or are all of the kids who, as recently as 5 years ago, were wearing Circle A's and leather jackets and mohawks co-opted by this neo-fascist red-brown stuff?
О молодежи как таковой в целом сейчас в России, в общем-то, говорить достаточно сложно, потому что разные группы, разные категории молодежи, занимающиеся разными вещами, да еще к тому же в разных регионах, могут занимать вообще совершенно разные позиции.
It's difficult to speak of youth as a whole in Russia, because there are different sectors of population, there are different regions, and the situation could be quite different from one region to another and among different segments of youth.
В первый момент, в начале 90-х годов, казалось, что едва ли не большинство молодежи увлеклось западными либеральными ценностями.
In the beginning of 1990s, it seemed that most of Russian youth is very much became kind of indoctrinated with Western bourgeois ideas.
Сразу возникло очень большое, вдруг появилось неожиданно большое количество молодых людей, которые захотели стать предпринимателями.
All of a sudden, there was an enormous number of young people who wanted to become entrepreneurs.
Ну, сейчас по России гуляет шутка, что самая распространенная профессия среди молодежи через 5-10 лет это будет профессия безработного предпринимателя.
So now there's a joke goes around that the most popular or numerous profession in Russia in 5 to 10 years would be an unemployed entrepreneur.
Ну и, соответственно, конечно, реакция вот на такое положение у разных групп молодежи самая разная.
And the reaction of different sectors of youth, different groups, is different to this situation.
Кто вообще перестал интересоваться политикой, занимается исключительно личными проблемами?
Some people just forgot about politics altogether and trying to solve the personal problems.
Кто идет в фашистские группы?
Some join the fascists.
Кто продолжает поддерживать какие-то предпринимательские или либеральные организации?
Some continue to support some kind of liberal or entrepreneurial organizations.
Ну а какое-то количество людей, в общем, проявляет, по-прежнему проявляет некий интерес к анархизму.
And some people are still interested in anarchism.
Интересно, что когда вот лидер этой группы «Гражданская оборона» вот поменял резко фронт и выступил вот с подобным заявлением на одном из своих концертов, немалое количество его слушателей, молодых панков, кричало: «Егор, ты сошел с ума, ты crazy».
It's interesting that when that band that we played in the beginning and talked a little bit, Civil Defense, when they sort of suddenly changed direction and turned nationalist, during the first concerts after that, a lot of people in the audience, like young punks, when Yegor Letov, the leader of the band, would start saying his newly found nationalist rhetoric, people would yell at him, saying, "Yegor, you are crazy. You've gone mad."
But I guess it was rather the position of a minority, as far as I guess this was during the press conference after the first Russian breakthrough event, that there were really people who were crying. I remember I heard this. I was personally there. A young girl crying, "Yegor, what happened to you? You always said you always said you are an anarchist." And I don't know if this is really a majority position.
I was at a conference in Amsterdam a few months ago, and there were some Russian delegates there. And I remember one guy stood up in the audience, I don't remember in reference to what, and gave this impassioned speech in which he said, "No more isms." You know, that he didn't want to hear about any isms. And suddenly this struck me that among a lot of Russians that I've been meeting, there's an incredible reaction against ideology, which I think, of course, is obviously to be blamed on history, and on the history of Stalinism in particular. But isn't this a baby in a bathwater situation? Aren't the Russian intellectuals in danger of throwing away their brains along with this denial of ideology? I mean, to resist ideology is one thing, but to refuse to think, that's something else. How do you read this situation? What's the sociology of this situation?
Ну, к сожалению, что касается меня, то я достаточно критичен в отношении состояния сегодняшней российской интеллигенции.
Unfortunately, I must say that my appraisal of the state of current state of the Russian intelligentsia is pessimistic.
Конечно, обобщать, в общем, всегда сложно в такой ситуации.
Of course, it's difficult to speak in generalities.
Но можно сказать, что вот некая такая гуманистическая струя, которая в российской интеллигенции присутствовала, некая струя симпатии к униженным, оскорбленным, обездоленным, эта струя, кажется, иссякла на сегодняшний день.
It seems like that a certain humanist tendency that was always present among the Russian intelligentsia the sympathy towards the dispossessed, the hurt, whatever, that tendency is dissipated, has dissipated.
Интеллигенция либо люмпенизируется и озлобленно молчит.
The intelligentsia is either lumpenized and is kind of keeping an angry silence.
Либо как элита ее, которая, в общем-то, и при старом режиме преуспевала, и при новом неплохо устроилась, объявляет о поддержке системы, о поддержке правительственной политики, которая является абсолютно антисоциальной.
Or the elite, which always sort of had its niche in the Soviet society, the elite of the intelligentsia supports the government policies, which are very antisocial.
Ну, например, совершеннейшим шоком было слушать заявление, скажем, такого, в общем, уважаемого мной человека, как Булат Акуджава, заявление о поддержке правительства и проводимой им политики.
It was shocking to hear some very respectable and respected people, as Vadim mentions, the singer Булат Акуджава, when they supported the bombing and storming of the parliament in October of 1903.
Для моего поколения он, ну, в общем, считался в какой-то степени, ну, олицетворением, ну, не олицетворением совести, это будет преувеличение, но, в общем, в какой-то степени, ну, эту совесть представлял.
For my generation, he, this singer, was the conscience of my generation, the voice of conscience.
И вдруг выясняется, что он же не может не знать, что происходит массовое обнищание, что многие люди недоедают, что существует масса социальных проблем, что людям очень тяжело жить. Он все это прекрасно понимает, но тем не менее продолжает поддерживать политику правительства, которое все это делает.
And he cannot not know of all the social problems that people are getting desperately poor and stuff like that, and still he supports this government policy.
Спрашивается, где же гуманизм?
So where is the humanism?
И, наконец, часть интеллигенции, значительная часть, подалась вправо. Националисты, фашисты.
And also a substantial part of Russian intelligentsia went to the right and joined the fascists.
Did I misunderstand? The Band Civil Defense supported Yeltsin in the storming of parliament back in October 1993?
No, surely not. I think this is rather a crucial event which brought this band on the other side.
Right.
No,
that's what I would
imagine. About a different singer, not associated with that band.
Okay.
He's an older person.
I believe Eleanor Foreman, our troubleshooter here in the studio tonight, has got a question for you guys as well.
I noticed that at several points you were mentioning about how other political groups were accusing you of Satanist, even Jewish influences, and Jewish considered demonic, that Christianity should be abandoned because Jews thought it up. And I didn't hear you really address the fact that Jewish thinkers have been prominent among anarchical thought and are not demons.
But this was a position, this was clearly a position of the nationalists, so this is not, it has to be said that anti-Semitism plays a very important role and really is one of the core or bases which combines left, Stalinist, Bolshevist left and the fascists. So I don't know if I understood you really. If I give a quotation of a national patriot who for instance, says that rock music is a product of dark satanic forces or Zionist forces, I just try to illustrate how crazy these people are. I mean, I think it's natural that I don't share such views, you know?
I got a report about, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, the Youth Action Against Fascism group, which has been formed in Russia, but it appears to be under the sway of Yegor Gaidar, who was one of course one of the architects of the whole neoliberal policy to which you know, this fascist movement is in fact a reaction and a backlash. So in my mind, that makes him somewhat suspect. Are you familiar with them?
Ну, дело в том, что когда такие люди, как Гайдар и его окружение начинают говорить об антифашизме, это, в общем, в какой-то степени смешно, в какой-то трагично.
When such people as Егор Гайдар and people in his circle start talking about anti-fascism, it's on one hand funny and then it's also tragic.
Дело в том, что именно вот та социально-экономическая политика, которую проводил Гайдар и продолжает в какой-то степени проводить нынешнее правительство, оно, собственно, и открывает, оно прокладывает дорогу фашизму.
It should be said that the social-economic policy that was conducted by Егор Гайдар when he was deputy prime minister, and which is to some extent still being conducted by the government, this policy paves the way for fascism.
Я очень боюсь, что многие люди, узнав, что Гайдар антифашист, скажут: ну если он антифашист, то мы будем фашистами.
And I'm afraid, frankly, that a lot of people, when they hear that Егор Гайдар is an anti-fascist, their reaction will be: well, then I'm a fascist.
Ну, а вообще-то такую организацию я, конечно, знаю. Она называется «Радикальное молодежное действие».
But I'm familiar with this organization that you mentioned. It's called Radical Youth Movement.
Оно действует,
Radical Youth Action.
Оно действует в составе такой либеральной группировки под названием Московский антифашистский центр.
It exists under the umbrella of a liberal grouping called Moscow Anti-Fascist Center.
Но позиция этого центра и особенно вот этой молодежной группировки очень странная.
But the positions that the center takes, and especially this youth movement, are quite strange.
Они заявляют, собственно, с их точки зрения, все, что не является либерализмом, все это фашизм.
From their point of view, everything that is not liberalism mm-hmm. is fascism. Mm-hmm.
Они призывают, скажем, к запрету любых организаций, которые сеют национальную и социальную рознь.
They want to ban any kind of organizations that, quote, spread national and social discord.
Mm-hmm.
Возникает вопрос, ну хорошо, а если профсоюз организует забастовку против предпринимателя и требует повышения зарплаты, это что, фашизм?
So then we should ask, well, if a trade union starts a strike against some employer demanding higher wages, is that fascism?
Mm-hmm. And they might say yes, in other words.
И они скажут да?
Они скажут да.
I think that's...
Yes,
they would say yes.
It's well, there are strikes going on all over Russia. Beyond the obvious bread and butter issues involved, you know, workers going for months without pay and so on, is there any particular political tendency which is dominant in the labor movement?
К сожалению, забастовки, которые в России происходят, они не находятся, не соответствуют уровню, действительно, реальному уровню кризиса.
Unfortunately, the strikes that do take place in Russia are not up to the level of the real crisis that Russian society is in.
Эти стачки очень малорешительны, весьма малорешительны.
These strikes are timid, they're too timid.
Они полностью под контролем соглашательских профсоюзов.
They're completely under the control and direction of trade union organizations, which are too eager to compromise.
Да и требования-то, в общем, весьма умеренные.
And the demands are quite moderate.
Mm-hmm.
Люди требуют в основном, прежде всего, чтобы им регулярно выплачивали зарплату.
People demand, first of all, that their pay, their wages, be actually paid to them on a regular basis.
Поскольку ее не выплачивают в течение очень часто многие не получают зарплату в течение нескольких месяцев. Это власти так борются с инфляцией.
Because many people don't get paid for month at a time,
right.
And this is a way for the government to fight inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Ну и работники общественного сектора, работники так называемой бюджетной сферы. Они требуют, естественно, субсидий от государства.
And people who work in the public sector, in enterprises that receive some funding from the state budget, demand also increased share of that budget.
И в такой ситуации, конечно, разные категории трудящихся оказываются в различной ситуации. Кто-то в более выгодной, кто-то менее.
So in this situation, some workers are in more favorable position and some are less favorable.
Те, кто как шахтеры могут взять правительство за горло, те могут добиться на какое-то время удовлетворения своих требований.
Those like the miners, for example, who can sort of put their hands on the government's throat, they can get the demands satisfied, maybe temporarily or to some extent.
Mm-hmm. But is the union leadership basically not questioning the overall neoliberal project?
Не подвергает сомнению весь неолиберальный проект?
Нет.
No.
No, they're not questioning
No.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Нет. Практически все из крупных реальных профсоюзов, существующих сейчас в России, заявляют, что не верны социальному партнерству. Они как бы просят правительство, ну стань же, наконец, нашим социальным партнером. А правительство говорит, а зачем вы нам нужны?
Most of those trade unions, they are proclaiming social partnership. But what happens is they have to beg the government, please be our social partner. And the government is saying, well, we don't need you.
Mm-hmm. Are these unions left over from communist days? Or are these all new organizations?
Это и остатки старых профсоюзов, и новые профсоюзы.
It's both, the remnants of the old and some new ones. Mm-hmm.
Только, к сожалению, еще и неизвестно, кто хуже.
But unfortunately, it's hard to say which is worse.
Потому что если в старых профсоюзах еще старые профсоюзы, поскольку их много, они еще пытаются иногда как-то что-то заявлять, хотя бы умеренно оппозиционное, то новые профсоюзы, большинство из них, во всяком случае, заявляли до сих пор, что они полностью поддерживают правительство.
Because the old trade unions, the remnants of the communist system, they're more numerous, and so they have some more weight. And they're sometimes they're trying to say something moderately oppositional to the government, but the majority of the new trade unions, until now at least, supported the government.
So they're more or less taking their lead from the AFL-CIO, the new movements.
Is there direct influence from American labor?
I'm sure AFL is there.
Есть профсоюзы, которые прямо и непосредственно поддерживаются AFL-CIO.
There are some trade unions, there's new trade unions that are directly supported by AFL-CIO.
В Москве существует специальный институт профсоюзных исследований, созданный AFL-CIO.
AFL-CIO established an institute of trade union research in Moscow.
Oh, the AFL, the American Institute for Free Labor Development, which was used by the AFL-CIO in league with the Central Intelligence Agency to co-opt labor movements in Central America and so on, is active in Russia, I'm aware, right now.
Я не совсем себе представляю, так сказать, юридическое взаимоотношение с американским центром подобного института. Нет, институт.
Well, we have 5 minutes left, so I would like to ask, what's the future going to be like? Now you have a chance to look into your crystal ball. I'd like to ask this question of each of you, but keep it brief. I'm so sorry to say. What positive forces are there that we as Americans, for example, could take an interest in, even to support? And how do you see all this coming out in the near future?
Ну, анархисту трудно быть пророком, поскольку в объективные какие-то исторические законы анархисты не верят.
The anarchists usually don't believe in some objective historical laws. So it's hard for us to predict the future.
Поэтому я постараюсь ответить очень коротко.
So I'll be brief.
Анархист, с нашей точки зрения, до тех пор, пока люди в нашей стране не научатся защищать свои права, борясь за них, до тех пор ничего хорошего для населения России не предвидится.
As an anarchist, I can say that until such time when the Russian people learn to defend their rights and to struggle for their rights, nothing good will come of it.
Что же касается, скажем, поддержки со стороны западных держав или Соединенных Штатов какого-либо из кандидатов в президенты, то я думаю, что Америка и с Зюгановым вполне уживется.
As for the Western countries, Western states supporting one or another candidate for presidency of Russia, I think that the U.S. will do quite well with Zyuganov even.
Ну, к конечно, при одном условии. Если Зюганов откажется от роли всемирной сверхдержавы и признает, что Россия может сыграть роль региональной сверхдержавы, которая будет, так сказать, усмирять окружающую территорию в интересах тех же западных.
Under one condition that Zyuganov will accept that Russia is not a world superpower, but a regional superpower, mm-hmm. which will sort of keep in check the surrounding
And he can just
countries.
Sort of play regional cop for global yeah. capitalism, ironically. I was going to ask the obvious question, if you can address it briefly. What about, the name which is much more familiar to people in the West than Zyuganov is Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who I understand just had some kind of summit meeting with Jean-Marie Le Pen in Moscow.
Zhirinovsky действительно очень похож на Le Pen. Но в настоящий момент у него вряд ли есть шансы прийти к власти в стране.
Yeah, Zhirinovsky is actually quite similar to Le Pen, but at present I don't think he has a lot of chances to win the elections.
Другое дело, что Ельцин, борясь с Зюгановым, усиливает Жириновского, причем делает это сознательно.
On the other hand, Yeltsin, in his struggle against Zyuganov, is purposely strengthening Zhirinovsky.
Mm-hmm.
Ельцина даже уже кое-кто окрестил Гинденбургом.
Some people started to call Yeltsin Gindenburg.
Mm. Будет ли Жириновский Адольфом? Кто его знает?
It remains to be seen whether Жириновский will become
right.
Adolf.
Right, right. Well, the final question as we wrap it up
final,
here.
Yeah,
we've
got to get out of here.
Who can we support? Who are the
that means we as anarchists, not we America.
Yes, exactly. not using the pronoun we to refer to the U.S. government, but those of us in the.
Yeah. Do you mean for presidents or?
Well,
no,
just in general.
No, I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about activist to activist solidarity.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Who are the activists in Moscow who we, like-minded activists here, anti-fascists, anarchists, etc., here in New York?
Name an address, even, if
yeah.
you've got it.
Maybe I'm in a better position to answer this question.
Please.
Because if I say you should support Vadim's group, Cross, which is an anarcho-syndicalist group, he does not have to say it for himself. So.
Well, go ahead and say it then.
So
if there's a PO box number, let's have it.
I see a very limited groups which should be supported in Russia, but one of them is certainly this Cross group, which is a split from IRIAN. The other half of the IRIAN went to the Red Brown Youth Movement.
IRIAN was some pre-existing anarchist organization.
Yeah. I mean, we as anarchists from Germany also supported. This Cross group, and we also support another group in the Ukraine, which is the former Federation of Anarchists from the Donbas, and now it is called ERKAS, Revolutionary Confederation of Anarcho-Syndicalists. And there might be some other groups, or individuals.
I suppose neither East nor West here in New York is acting to disseminate.
Yeah, precisely. And in fact, yeah. I was asked to inform our listeners that neither East nor West is meeting regularly, organizing solidarity for anti-fascist and other activists in Russia and the former Soviet bloc. If you want to find out about their next meeting, you can actually give my voicemail a call at 631-1115. Leave your information and I'll get back to you. If you want to check out neither East nor West, 631-1115. And solidarity with the beleaguered anti-fascist resistance in Russia.
And thank you all very much for coming. A very interesting show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with some music by Paul Bowles and some Turkish Sufi music. And other musical fare is what we have lined up. So come back in a fortnight. We'll see you then. Assalamu alaikum.
We've been with Marcus Mathil and Vadim Damir of CRAS, Russian Confederation of Revolutionary Anarcho-Syndicalists, and Misha Gutkin translating for us. This has been the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Stay tuned for Weaponry coming up next, where
music,
Elizabeth Forman is actually going, Eleanor Forman, excuse me, is actually going to be reading from the works of Gene Sharp, the nonviolence theorist, on weaponry, which certainly means that somebody somewhere is getting religion.
Do we have some music to go out with?
Coming up.
Okay. Yes. Well, that's all a matter of speaking.
It's just that too, isn't it?
Technological. There we are. All right. See ya.